We're going to talk about data. For the past 30, 40 years, humankind has been accumulating massive amounts of data of all types, and a lot of this data, or most of this data now, is digitized, and the question is what to do with it. Data in and of itself is a neutral thing, but human beings can do all kinds of things with it, some good, some neutral, quite a few bad things, and so I hope we'll hear about these different options from our speakers today. Our first speaker is Brett Goldstein. He's senior fellow in urban science at the Harris School, former chief data officer at the City of Chicago, and holds a degree from our university, and currently resides in Chicago with his wife and three children.
All right, so the after... Wrong deck. I could pretend I'm Ian Foster, so hi, I'm Dr. Ian Foster. Or we could do a quick... Do you want to just go?
It's... You're following a different order than the slides.
Oh, yeah, so...
Okay, I'm following the order in an email that I got.
Yeah, okay. So Ian is way more interesting than I am, and he's super smart, so okay. Do you want to do the intro?
I'll go.
Okay.
Ian is an old colleague of mine, and I learned something new, that he's senior software engineer at CenturyLink Labs. I know him as the head of the Computation Institute at the University of Chicago and one of the pioneers of grid computing. So, Ian.
That was amusing, because just before we started, Brett and I sort of jokingly said maybe we should give each other slides, which would have been, for me, very difficult, because he's much smarter than I am. But anyway, so... I'm glad I am first, actually, because I want to start off with some sort of high level perspectives on data, and I think we'll get into some more specifics with some of the later speakers. So I want to talk about some of the forces that are driving an explosion of data in areas that concern me, which is various areas of the sciences, and then some of the things that we need to do and that we are doing to make that data be really useful. So I'm talking about the sciences where things are mostly good, I think, to do with data. I won't mention the NSA during this presentation. The sciences, seeking to understand the world, that's where people at the university, at Argonne National Lab, where I work, and others focus their time. It's, of course, not where most people who work with data reside. Most of them are probably trying to work out how to sell advertising to you more effectively. A friend of mine who works in the software industry misquotes Ginsberg and talks about the best minds of our generation are working out how to make people click on ads. But that's not what we're talking about here. So the data deluge, I'm sure we're all familiar with this. And of course, it's due in part to things that we're well aware of. You know, the decreasing cost of storage, our increased ability to generate data via computations. But what is, we should also be aware that it's partly driven also by very rapid changes in technology, which in a sense is the same Moore's law changes in silicon density, but also other technological advances. So this was mentioned earlier. You saw a similar slide to this. It was pointing the other direction, but it's the same trend. Rapidly decreasing cost of sequencing a human genome, which not that long ago cost several billion dollars for one, and now is getting pretty close to 1,000. You'll actually see that, as often happens with technology, we've got this precipitous decline, far faster than Moore's law decline, and then a leveling off. But there are many and very smart people working out how to transform the sequencing technology yet again. So we're going to see yet another decline in the cost of human genome data, which will have clearly remarkable scientific implications. It will actually also have some potentially very concerning policy implications, but I won't talk about that because I'm just a technical guy. So, but this pointed out some other directions in which things are changing. So this is what's called a nanosat. I don't know why it's... I've just got a new laptop and it's got a mind of its own. I think we were talking about that earlier in the Bob Kowalski's talk. I don't know if anyone has come across these things. So, you know what a satellite is. We used to build them over in the High Bay on campus. They're billion-dollar devices. You spend years creating in them and then send them up into space. A microsat or a nanosat is sort of the opposite. The standard configuration is 10 centimeters on a cube. You can put multiple of them together, as you see here, to get a 40 by 10 by 10 centimeter cube. They cost a few $1,000s, a few $100,000s, and you send them up by the bucket load, I think is the term. People were sending up tens of them at once. Soon they'll be sending thousands of them up at once. And then we'll be able to use these to image the entire surface of the planet. It may be like 90 centimeter resolution, so not as much as the NSA can do, but pretty good. But on a every hour or so that we'll be able to see changes to our environment very, very rapidly. And then I couldn't resist putting this picture up. So does anyone know what this is? It's I saw where they were made yesterday. It's very strange. It's a drone. Oh, it's changed again. So this is a graveyard, but we won't talk about that. So this is what's called a underwater autonomous drone. And amazingly, these were designed at Scripps Institute of Oceanography, but they're actually manufactured in Chicago, just near O'Hare Airport. I went to visit the factory actually on Thursday, not yesterday. So this is about this high. It weighs about 20 kilograms. You throw it in the ocean, and it basically it can live out there for 3 years, going down to about 2,000 meters. Current versions, they're planning one that will go down to 6,000 meters, taking a temperature, salinity, a pressure profile, and then go back up very rapidly because it's very dangerous to be on the surface. Data up to an Iridium satellite, and then repeat, and they do this hundreds of times. And this is transforming what we know about the deep ocean, and actually is providing some of the most definitive evidence to date for climate change, because we're finding out how much warming is really going on deep in the ocean, which is the big heat sink that we're concerned about. A remarkable device. And then I'll just show one more thing, although I think Brett may say more about this. I was concerned if he went first because he would have shown his picture of the array of things before me. This is a project based at the University of Chicago, putting up sensor pods around the city. And if you look, I think you can sort of see the idea. We want to put up hundreds initially, maybe thousands eventually, which... much like the autonomous drones, except these will be fixed, they will measure environmental data, air quality, temperature, light. They will not measure cell phone signals, which is one concern that people have, but they will, I think, start to provide us what we might call an environmental or an urban observatory. So these are all the new sources of data that are creating this... data avalanche or data deluge that we talk about. One concern that we should have, though, if we're scientists, is that for the most part, this data which we're collecting at such lengths is not accessible or available to us. So I thought, how could I best capture that? Well, a lot of data gets stuck into what we might call data graveyards. Come back. A data graveyard is something where you put things to make sure, well, if you put things in a graveyard, you know it's not going to go anywhere, but it's not easily accessible. It's not certainly easy to communicate with. It's not certainly easy to connect one piece of whatever you put in the graveyard with another. And these are all the things that we need to be able to do if we're going to make sense of large amounts of data. So let me say a few words about some of the things that people are doing to try and break down these barriers of accessibility and communicativeness. How about that? So one thing that we've learned to do very well over the last few years and is to move large amounts of data around. So this is a looks a bit like the beautiful glass that my mother has on her table, but it's actually a cross-section through an oceanic cable. So this is various forms of some of these little bits in here are optical fibers, some are armor plating, etc. One of these things can transfer with current technology close to 10 terabits per second, which if you multiply it out means that in half a day you can move every word ever written by a human, which is, according to the internet, is about 50 petabytes. Seems high to me, but in any case. So we can move data at tremendous rates. One of the things that my group does, which is we find great fun, but maybe isn't so interesting to you, is working out how to manage the movement of these huge data flows around the world. And so this is a picture that we created recently that shows, so if you go to globus.org, you can see a counter ticking over as showing the number of megabytes we're moving at any one time. And this picture here shows, this is the size of amount of data people are moving, up to 100 terabytes at a time. This is how far they're moving it. So the furthest you can move data on the planet, I guess, is about 24,000 kilometers. Otherwise, you run out of room. And this is the speed people are moving it at. So it's you might think, why is there's very little data being moved 5,000 kilometers? 5,000. That's because there are very few places on the planet that are 5,000 kilometers apart. The oceans get in the way. So I thought that was an interesting observation. So that's we can actually move huge amounts of data around the planet. So that's a first nice step. Secondly, we can make data more accessible. Instead of sticking it into data graveyards, we can stick it into vast, what people nowadays call clouds. We used to call them other things, data grids and such like. So this is a Google data center, which could hold certainly much more than the 50 petabytes than we can move in across the Atlantic in a 10 terabit network in 12 hours. We can start to load data up into vast arrays. So most of these arrays today are being used to hold presumably Google search data and advertising information, dull stuff. But increasingly we're starting to create data hubs or commons, they're sometimes called, that support scientific research purposes. For example, at the University of Chicago, one of my colleagues, Bob Grossman, is leading a effort called the Genomics Cancer Commons, basically loading as much genomic data relating to cancer as he can get his hands on, which at the moment I think is about 3 petabytes, which is a fairly large amount, in such a form that people can start asking questions about it quasi and getting answers quasi-instantaneously. Now, you know, we heard earlier that simply being able to process lots of data is not useful if you can't get accurate results. But on the other hand, if you can't process lots of data very quickly, you're in trouble. So we're putting in place machinery that lets you ask those sorts of questions. So let me just give you a couple of examples to close of the sorts of things we can do when we have large amounts of data available to us in such a form that it can be easily linked together. So this is the first one is work by another colleague of mine, Andrei Rozetsky, who's in the Computation Institute and the Department of Medicine. So he's a very smart fellow. So it occurred to him to get hold of large amounts of insurance claim data and plus a whole bunch of census data, and then to link those together to find out where is it that people seem to be suffering from autism spectrum disorder and intelligence deficiencies. And so that's what you see here. So you'll see, essentially, there are these interesting geographic concentrations of high concentrations of autism. Then the next thing he did was he said, well, what could possibly be causing those connections? So then he got a hold of another entirely different data set. So actually, no, in this case, the next step is he looked for something else in this data. So it turns people believe that there's a useful marker for human exposure to toxins during pregnancy and early childhood, is particularly pregnancy, I guess, is the amount of mutations or in the male reproductive system. in other words, sort of penile abnormalities. So he got that data and then started correlating it with this, and what you find out is that it looks like these areas have large, above-average exposure to some sort of environmental toxin. He doesn't know what yet, but he's now seeking to find out. So he's starting to look, for example, at databases of use of pesticides and other, or also information about soil properties in those different regions. So that's one thing that you can start to do when you build environmental data commons plus and link it to a biomedical data commons. I'll give you one more example. This is a project that I'm involved in where we're taking data about current groundwater, current crop yields, current water consumption due to agriculture, and then combining that with projections of future climate to look at what might happen, to water demands from agriculture over the next 100 years under climate change scenarios. And what we find out is something quite shocking, really, the degree to which we're going to be short of fresh water in large amounts of particularly the lower latitude regions. Okay, so I wanted to finish with one final comment. So I was talking to students at lunchtime, and they were telling me how they spent part of their time reading Marx and the other part of their time being taught the principles of Friedman. So I thought it might be interesting to think, how are we going to ensure that the data we need for science is available to us in the future? And sort of two principles. Do we assume that everyone's going to make all data available to everyone for free, or are we going to find a way to use payment mechanisms to incentivize production and share data? And so if we had time, we could try and talk a bit about that. Thank you very much.
So Michelangelo D'Agostino, he's a lead data scientist with Civis Analytics, where he works on statistical models and writes software for data analysis. He comes to us from particle physics, where they have to analyze a lot of data. And he started in particle astrophysics and sifting through data acquired in the Ice Cube experiment, and then decided that maybe he's more interested in analyzing data about human beings, I guess.
Great. Thanks for that introduction. It's really great to be here at this conference on technology and society. As Professor Amit said, my name is Michelangelo, and I work at a company called Civis Analytics. For those of you who aren't familiar with Civis, we are a data science advisory and software company located here in Chicago. And what I'm going to do quickly today is tell you a little bit about who we are as a company, but really try to zero in on a bunch of case studies and actual client problems that we've worked on over the last couple years. And the reason I'm doing that is not to give you guys a sales pitch about our company, but actually, so Ian stole a quote I was going to use about best minds of our generation, working on optimizing ad click-through rates on websites. And when we think about it, I don't think there are tons of terrible people out there who analyze data who just want to optimize click-through rates and e-commerce conversion rates. But really what we see is that there's a real thirst for people with technical skills who work with data to work on problems that matter, but they have trouble figuring out how to do that, where they can do that, and notable success stories for how to work with data on problems that really matter. So I'm hoping that by telling you some of the work we do as a company, that you can kind of get a glimpse into some of the possibilities that are out there for using data and data science and data analytics and computer science and all these sorts of buzzword techniques to really work on problems that matter for human beings and for society. So Civis as a company really had its origins in the 2012 Obama re-election campaign. So a large chunk of our initial staff worked on the data analytics operation in Chicago for the campaign. So these were, statisticians, computer scientists, people with physics degrees, a professional poker player, who came to Chicago to work on data, on analytics, sort of in all facets of the campaign's operation. So personally, I used to be a particle physicist. I was doing research out at Argonne, and I saw an ad calling for all these different kinds of technical people to come work on the campaign. And so on the campaign, we did all sorts of things. So we had survey methodologists who were designing the best ways to do phone polls. We had trained social scientists and political scientists who were running randomized controlled experiments like you do in pharmaceutical research, but just in interventions that take place in a political context. We had predictive modelers, people with expertise in machine learning, building statistical models of individual behavior. And we use these statistical models basically to build a scientific understanding of each voter, and then to direct all of our strategies and tactics towards what these models were telling us about voters. And then we use that that understanding to basically direct all of the decisions and all of the resources that the campaign had at its disposal. So more specifically, like, what does it actually mean to be doing this kind of individual level modeling and targeting? So traditionally, the way things were done in politics is that people were addressed in these kind of broad demographic slices. So soccer moms think this way, NASCAR dads behave that way. And if you're a NASCAR dad, every NASCAR dad looks the same, right? And so what we were able to do in 2012 was to basically make granular predictions at the individual level based off of things that people were telling us and things they were telling us on the phone, things they were telling us at people's doors, and data we had about them as individuals, to actually go down to a finer level and say, what is this specific, you know, soccer mom likely to do? And so each person basically had a couple of really important model scores assigned to them. Let's see if I can make this work. So the first was an individual level probability of how likely you were to support President Obama as a candidate. And the second was how likely you were to actually show up and vote on election day. And each dot on here is a person. You can see this two-dimensional plane. And basically where you fall directs how the campaign talks to you or what sorts of outreach we would do. So if you are over here, you're very, very likely to support our candidate, but you're not so likely to actually show up to vote. We spend resources trying to convince you that you should register to vote and actually show up on election day. If you're down here, where you are, you know, you're very likely to actually show up and vote, but you maybe are on the fence about whether you support the candidate, these people are people that you want to talk to try to convince them to change their opinions, talk to them about policy, and really not actually talk to them about voting because they're already voting, but talk to them about persuasion. And then people up in this right corner who are really, really likely to support you and really, really likely to vote, you don't need to convince them of anything, really, but these are the people that you want to ask to volunteer, talk to their friends, give you money, and all that sort of stuff. So using these individual level scores, we were really able to get down to a granular level and direct messaging and outreach to people based on where they were at, meeting them where they were at. And so since the campaign, we've basically been taking this work centered around individual modeling and extending it to other political campaigns, but also throughout the world of nonprofits and companies. And you can see here just sort of a spectrum of some of our clients. But what I'd like to do now is go through some examples of work we've done over the last couple of years that really focuses on this individual level predictive modeling, but using it in a way that is not just to make you click on ads, but in a way that is designed to help with what we think are important, larger scale societal problems that our partner organizations are trying to address. So the first has to do with the ACA, the Affordable Care Act. So if you've been paying any attention to anything really over the last 5 years, you'll know about the Affordable Care Act and Obamacare. And you know, depending on your point of view, this is either a really great thing that's going to help more people be insured, or it's an omen of the end of days. I will not try to convince you of one or the other. But the point was that when this was passed, there were lots of organizations who were out there trying to educate people who didn't have insurance about what they were eligible for, how they could go about getting insurance, how they could get enrolled in the healthcare that they never had. The problem is that there's no list of people there's no list of uninsured Americans. So they didn't know who to go out and talk to. And a lot of these are small organizations. They don't have huge budgets, so they can't just kind of go out and carpet bomb the Super Bowl with ads. They have to direct their resources efficiently. So what we did was that we built in 2013 and in 2014 individual level predictive models based off of large scale phone surveys asking people about their insurance status, and then melding that data with data coming from the census, data coming from consumer vendors, and all sorts of individual level data to then predict on a scale of, you know, 0 to 100 how likely you were and each individual person was to actually not be insured. And this graphic just shows some of our data that was in the New York Times showing the change in those model scores from year to year to see where people were getting coverage that first year of the Affordable Care Act. And so this is useful. This map shows Chicago, kind of the density of our scores for people that were likely to have to be uninsured. And this is useful because a lot of these organizations were on the ground knocking on doors, making phone calls, setting up booths, trying to enroll people. And when you're doing that, we were able to actually provide them with lists. So like you're in Atlanta and you want to walk through this neighborhood and knock on doors, who are like the top 100 people you should actually go out and talk to? Because we think with good certainty, these are people who are actually likely to be uninsured. So we could do that, and then we could take it one step further, and we can actually match the scores we have for people to be uninsured with data we have on media consumption habits. So we can say, we can create an index that says, of these different television networks, which are the channels that people who are very likely to be uninsured are actually watching? And so it's hard, I'm sure you can't see the labels out here, but the top couple are Spanish language networks, networks likely to be watched by people who are younger, you know, not under 26, but maybe slightly above that. And with that information, and the other end of the spectrum are places where you might not expect to find people who are uninsured, like HGTV, where you're figuring out how to renovate your house and do all sorts of stuff like that. But basically marrying these scores with this consumption data allows us to tell our clients, if you're placing ad campaigns, where exactly should you place those ad campaigns to reach the uninsured people that you care about? And when you do that, you find that you actually save a lot of money and they can reach the people they care about for much less money. We've had clients who are interested in doing healthcare outreach. So talking to people who are at risk of diabetes or heart disease. But in a similar way, you know, you might have data on your individual hospital and which patients have diabetes, but you want to do a broader outreach. How do you figure out which people are at risk for these diseases? So we can do similar modeling off of survey data and census data and consumer data to come up with different disease risk maps. And again, these are not going to be as precise as if you actually have someone's medical data, but the goal here is really that if you have a broad idea of what individual people are at risk, you can be much more efficient even without knowing with medical certainty that people are at risk of these things. So we partnered with the Chicago Department of Public Health on a program using some of these models that we built. So Roseland Hospital, Roseland Community Hospital, runs a program where they will do free mammograms for women who are uninsured. And so they wanted to mail out these postcard flyers to people, but they didn't have a great idea about how to actually do that. And so we were able to, with a combination of our models, to say, these are women specifically in the age ranges you care about who are very likely to be uninsured, and this is where you should be trying to convince them to take advantage of this program. So another case study, we've worked with lots of nonprofits, but we worked with, in particular with one very large national public health nonprofit, and they were having a problem where they call tens of thousands of people asking them to donate, and they were seeing lots of decreases in donations. They didn't have the resources to call all of their donors, so they were really only calling people who had just donated very, very recently, and not people who were sort of lapsed donors who had donated a little while ago. And what we were able to do for them was basically take data from like 40 different data sources that they had access to but had never looked at together. And we were able to say to them, these are the actual people you should prioritize calling, both because they're likely to pick up the phone and because, conditional on picking up the phone, they're actually likely to donate to you. So this shows, if we kind of take deciles of our score, where on the right, these are people we said are very, very likely to donate, sort of the expected donation rate. But more interesting to them was that there were actually people who were lapsed donors who had donated, you know, not super, super recently, that they never would have called in their program that we told them were actually good targets that they should prioritize their outreach towards. We've done some work in the education space. So we've done work with a large public university, and this university has actually done some really interesting work around trying to get off of the, I guess I'll call it the U.S. News and World Report treadmill, where they're, you know, just basically trying to become more and more selective and rejecting more and more students. What they've decided to do is let in a student body that looks as much like the U.S. population as possible, and then once they're there, they're going to focus on making sure that everyone actually graduates. They really want to prioritize student retention. So what we were able to do for them was basically take a lot of data from a lot of their different internal university sources and come up with some models that tell them how likely various students are to actually not complete their studies, how likely they are to drop out. The models, I won't go through some of the statistics, but the models performed really well and actually jibed really well with what their internal sort of gut feel was about what students were doing. But what it could do by giving them an actual specific list of students, allow them to, they can't address every student on an individual level. It allowed them to prioritize their outreach to say, actually, these are the top students that we should direct our outreach and our counseling towards because they're most at risk of not staying. Similarly, we did some work around high school educational data. So we worked with a large national education nonprofit, and they had a concern about where high school students were deciding to go to college. They were concerned that there were students who were only applying to colleges that were much worse than their kind of true academic potential. And so again, the unglorious part of data work that no one really talks about is that, you know, most of these organizations have 20, 30, 40 data sources that have never been brought together, and most of the work is bringing all of these ugly data sources together. But once we were able to do that, we got kind of a complete picture of students, and we were able to say to them, so if this is a plot of academic potential as proxied by your SAT score, and on this axis, which colleges you applied to, so at the top, you know, top-tier schools down to kind of for-profit two-year colleges, that if you just draw a vertical line in here, these are all students of sort of the same academic potential, but there are some students who are applying to very, very good flagship universities, and there are some students who show what we were calling this opportunity gap. They sort of sell themselves short and only apply to colleges that are much worse than what they could have gotten into. And so by looking at sort of the demographics of this trend and the economics of this trend, you get a story that makes a lot of sense, and then you can, again, build individual level scores to help these organizations say, which high school students should we be zeroing in on for interventions? If we're going to mail them vouchers for applications or mail them pre-filled out applications, who are the students we really should direct this outreach towards to be most effective? So another interesting problem that we've worked on recently is the problem of persuasion. So this is back to the political context. So we want to know, if you show someone a TV commercial, if you send a piece of mail to someone's house, how likely is it to change that person's mind? And I don't want to get into too many details about this, but this is a really interesting intersection of data science, machine learning, and sort of social science, where what we do is devise randomized controlled experiments where you can show TV commercials to some people and not other people and sort of look to see who has their opinion changed. And based off of that, you can, again, efficiently direct your outreach. Last case study, last example. So we're working with a large educational nonprofit who's really interested in understanding kind of perception around an education reform issue. But the problem is that there's not really any way for them to know what people's existing opinions are. And so we took a bunch of our people who are experts in doing public polls and a bunch of people who are experts in doing modeling to come up with a basically recurring poll and a modeling technique that allows us to say, these are the raw numbers coming out of your poll over time. And it's really noisy, and it's not necessarily clear what the trend is there and how much should you actually believe these movements. And a way to sort of smooth it out with modeling techniques to give them a pretty coherent explanation of how public opinion is trending on this issue, and then more specifically, which groups are going up or going down in support for this education reform issue. And in a similar way to what I mentioned earlier, you can then marry these kinds of scores up with people's media viewing habits to say, okay, I want to send out somebody to talk on TV and really try to get support for this education reform issue. Which news programs or which channels should they actually go out and try to book time on because they're most dense and people that are likely to either not be aware of this issue or not support this issue? Yeah, so that's the last case study I want to talk about. So I'm happy to answer questions later about any of this stuff in more detail. But really what I hope to leave you with is just that we're obviously not the only people doing very interesting work in the realm of data as applied to kind of social issues and nonprofit issues and social good issues. There's a really awesome program here at the university for those of you who are students called Data Science for Social Good, started by a former Obama campaign colleague. They're doing some awesome work in very similar areas. But really what we all hope to do, I think, is come up with examples of how this work can be applied in areas outside of, you know, just making people click on ads and making money, so that those of you who are interested in these sorts of opportunities can sort of have a goal in mind or some role model in mind for what kinds of projects are out there. Thanks.
So I speak to the startup world. I spent 5 years at the police department, the CPD, last as a commander of counterterrorism intelligence, running something called the Predictive Analytics Group. And then I worked for Mayor Emanuel as his chief data officer and chief information officer. And now I have my academic life. So I have multiple different lenses which I look at things. Today we're going to talk about what is the future world with data. And I'm fortunate that Ian and Michelangelo both spoke to that, so we can dive in and dive fast. So my focus is on cities. So we have this enormous amount of urban data. I'm a fellow of urban science, so I should care about such things. But as a chief data officer, I learned that the type of data we had from day one is, in fact, enormous. And it is very much underutilized. And looking at it from the lens of a city, there was such a disparity between what you would see at Facebook and Google and LinkedIn and what we would use in the city was remarkable. Or when I ran the predictive analytics group and we started to look at crime data, the way the crime data was typically handled was archaic. So let's talk about some of the data that you have. Data in a city, and much of what I'm talking about is data that they have today within their systems, is all over the place. You have everything from city service data. What is city service data? Imagine your pothole when you drive down Lakeshore Drive and you're irritated at that pothole, which happens to me all the time. And you call 311. You become a row in a database which tracks that. Brett Goldstein called about at this time, on this date, at this location, that is a piece of data. Or if I'm driving through a neighborhood and I call in some graffiti, or I'm upset about, you know, there's garbage on the street or there's an abandoned building. There is enormity, as I mentioned, of this data, and there's millions and millions of rows that come in every day. And some of that is incident data. So one of the things I talked about was when I was at the police department, I worked on predicting crime. So crime in Chicago, we have between 450 to 550,000 reported crimes every year. That may not be, from the CS hat, a big number. From a day-to-day hat, that is material. We talk about 911 data. You start looking at the 911 data sets, you're dealing with about 7 million rows of data a year. All of these incidents. And then as we got smarter, sort of post-2011, and started thinking about what one could call bigger data, we started thinking about the Twitters. At lunch, I was talking about how back in the day, people used to do this interesting thing called writing a letter. And so 10 years ago, if you were going to complain about a problem in a city, you would write a letter, and you would probably send it to an alderman and say, blah, 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 I'm frustrated, blah, 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 and then put it in the mail. And then a couple years ago, we started to see more and more of the magical emails coming in, and that was super great. But then what did we start seeing? We started to see a cohort that would just tweet out their complaints or their interactions. And that is how they wanted to communicate what they're seeing in the urban landscape. Now, you have two paths. You can just ignore it, which seems to me like a bad choice, or you can, in fact, listen. But historically, government wouldn't listen to these things at the municipal level. But it's something that would change. But it involves working with a different type of data, a data that's bigger, or something that's pretty near my heart, weather data. So much of what happens in a city is driven by weather. And there's far more to do than watching Mr. Skilling at night and having him give you your forecast. Instead, you can tap into the power of NOAA and figure out, how does that impact my potholes? Or more recently, what we've looked at is, what are the mathematical relationships between weather and crime? Pretty interesting. But then we have something that Ian mentioned, and our colleague Charlie Catlett would enjoy the call out, is array of things. The idea of urban sensors. So we're now going from this idea of having your traditional data, 311, 911, crimes, licenses, things like that, coupled with interesting things like Twitter. But then you have urban sensors. What is the temperature at this location? What is going on with the air? How many aggregated Bluetooth connections am I seeing at a given time? There used to be a day that wasn't very far off where you'd understand patterns of traffic and people in aggregate by years. Not terribly useful. When you move to sensor models, you're looking at by the minutes. This is a whole different way of thinking about data, but wrangling with a different type of data than you're used to. And it's also, data comes in many different types of form. Some are easier, like we all like structured data, right? The magic of your typical two-dimensional array. You have a spreadsheet, you have things like that. You have assigned fields, it makes it super easy. Or you have things like aggregated data. When we're talking about personal identifiable data, how do you manage that? How do we make sure, a few years ago, it was a lot easier to not get into trouble with data. It was easier to not get into trouble, but now as we put out more and more pieces of data, it's easier to start to identify people in odd ways, which is risky. So you need to think about aggregation. And then we talked about issues with sensor, but then unstructured pieces of data, like things like Facebook or going back to Twitter. How do you handle these strings which you wouldn't see before? We've done some basic work in it. If you look at things like 311 data, you have unstructured fields in which the residents can tell you about a problem. Okay, we never managed that really well. So you introduce things like dealing with stop words and tokenizing and things like that, which you had never dealt with in the urban sphere, but you need to start to work through. Now, part of the initiative has gained ground because of this whole open data thing. One of the reasons Mayor Emanuel hired me in 2011 was he had campaigned on this idea of open data. So for those of you who are new to Chicago, let's just say prior to 2011, the history of transparency, not so good. And if you were wanting to get information, you had to leverage the magical Freedom of Information Act. And then if you got super lucky, you would get a PDF. If you were less lucky, you would get a fax. And that was what we walked into, but Mayor Emanuel was very clear. And for those of you that know the mayor isn't just, we're going to have an open data program. It was, Brett, we're going to have the best open data program in the country, no questions asked. And so we launched this open data program, and what we did, and this speaks to what Ian, in part, into what Ian was talking about with accessibility, is start taking the data out of all these legacy transactional systems and put it into data.cityofchicago.org. And that way, we moved away from the old paradigm and started to put out data that was machine readable. So everyone from my mom could get on the interwebs and browse to the site and look up my salary, because that's technically public information. Or, you know, we were having a reunion early on and we were talking about writing code against the data portal and sucking it out, and if you want to grab it in JSON and do certain interesting things. And that was a big initiative, and it went from being a token data portal in Chicago to now being one of the biggest programs in the U.S. And it's available via an API. But as we look toward the future of open data, I've always been very hesitant. I'm very pleased with our progress here. However, I always fear that it will become what I call spreadsheets on the web, where you're just dumping data out and we're so focused on the count of data sets that we don't think about its utility, we don't think of the relevant metadata, none of these issues. And so we started a project at the University of Chicago, which we call the Planario Project, which ingests open data that has spatial attributes, and it's able to, via an API, return you everything that it knows about a given place. So here we are at International House, and you can call the API and say, do you know anything about 311, crime, business licensing, GPS, any of these different things, to try and focus on making all of this data useful. Because while it's important to quote-unquote free certain types of data, it being useful is actually more important. It being accessible is also important. And when you read articles in the New York Times that talks about data scientists and 80% of their work is data prep, that is problematic. We need to focus on making it easier. So then we talk about what are things we can do with this. And one of them, predictive analytics. So again, going back to where I started at the police department, I came up with this idea that instead of managing crime data the way that we always had, which was, let's look at the history, and if it happened there once, it's going to happen there again, or this idea of, let's just know where our bad areas are, we tried to change the paradigm and said within the predictive analytics group, yes, we know where all our bad areas are, but who is going to be a bad area tonight? And how do we intervene in the near term? And we don't have time today to sort of go into techniques, but the idea is using more robust and diverse data to capture what is going on in neighborhoods, in small microgeographies, capture that signal, identify when a behavior is going to emerge, and intervene. Now, other areas which are interesting, anomaly detection. And this is something as we have more and more sensors going out and the AOT program expands and this whole IoT initiative, how do we understand the difference between normal and abnormal? Now, that sounds exceptionally boring, but that is critical. If you are running a big city and you're tasked with watching it, with all the millions and millions of pieces of data that are constantly coming in, simply knowing that an area is acting within normal parameters with all of this multivariate data is critical. That is a huge win and something that we need to focus on in the future. Other pieces are situational awareness. We have a project that we launched for the NATO Summit in 2012, the Windy Grid Project. This was an interesting example of taking all of our spatial data, pumping into something, a platform called MongoDB, which was open source, kind of radical for a city, and then building a mapping layer on top and saying, what is happening here right now? And this was a new way of doing city business, and it was really exciting. And it was exciting because it was built in-house on open source at remarkably low cost. This is something you're going to continue to see in products happening with the City of Chicago and also in partnership with the university. And as you expand into situational awareness, you have examples like in San Francisco, they integrate with the parking system, and then again back to AOT with all the different pieces of data that will come in that will inform how you manage the city. Now, as we look to the future, it gets to the broader, as I mentioned, multivariate nature of the behavior that occurs. How do we, it's a fun visual, but how do you look at what's happening here and predict what will happen next? The problems we like to think about are, if I hit pause in the video, can you predict the next couple minutes? Now, that's critical when you're going into an abnormal state to start to figure out what is my tactical intervention. These are hard problems, but as more and more data comes in, as Ian spoke about, or Michelangelo talked about more and more of these techniques, the what happens next problem becomes pretty compelling. So where does this all take us? So we're going to sail through, 1 minute remaining. Okay. So this visual is actually worth it, so we'll just go a minute over. Part of understanding how a city works is understanding its flaws. One of the flaws that I fixate on is our unit of analysis. So in Chicago, we have wards, community areas, districts, beats, all of these different census tracts, census blocks, topologies that are based on political attributes. One of the projects we're working on at U of C is, how do you calculate areas of a city and generate units of analysis based on the attributes presented to you? So you have some fun graphics here where, you know, in this case, we're calculating the homogeneous areas based on unemployment, poverty rates, homicide rates, now multivariate, unemployment and poverty. And each time you can see in these examples, we're recalculating what the city works on. And when you start to think about these recalculations, you start to say, how can we tailor treatment? When you are able to tailor treatment based on the homogeneity of a given area, that is, in fact, a smarter city because you start to be able to move to a proactive rather than reactive model, which, of course, leads you to a more efficient city, because you're no longer operating in silos. But at the same time, you're giving your residents a proactive experience. You're preventing problems before they happen instead of the classic approach where you react. And that's a smarter way of doing business. Done. The sign can go down. Right. Thank you.
What was that movie with Tom Cruise where they could predict the crime and they came before it happened? Minority Report.
I've never heard that one before.
Right. Well, I'm going to start with a number of comments which will lead to questions. One thing we have to keep in mind, especially in social data, is it's heavily biased. How many of you have responded to a phone call asking for your opinion of something? And how many of you have shut down the phone? Yeah. So data is heavily biased. The other problem is, and this is something we teach in the statistics department here at the University of Chicago, is you can run a numerical algorithm on data always. Is the result relevant? Is the model you use appropriate? If the data you got is very biased, the result can be extremely wrong, and even more and more wrong the more data you have. So these are fundamental questions that came to my mind when I heard especially the last two talks. So I would ask Michelangelo, when you're trying to predict what to talk to an individual in the Obama campaign, and you run your data based on polls that are radically biased, how do you know that you're not missing a huge component of people? And related to that is this atomization of the political process into these small units of people that you might talk to about X but not talk to them about Y. Are you, in some sense, removing the political discourse from the process? I happen to be, and I'll finish with that and let Michelangelo, I actually happen to volunteer for the campaign for the guy who ran against this amazing mayor we have here, because I think the amazing mayor we have here, despite all the technology, does not take care of all the neighborhoods in Chicago. And I was subject to this very, quote unquote, smart mechanism of who you call and what you talk to them about. So at a certain point in that campaign, I was told when I make a call, I don't talk to them about politics anymore or anything. I just make sure they go and vote, because by now they know that this guy or this woman is going to vote for Chewy. I don't know, maybe 25% of the time that was true. It was very random. So the big picture question is, given all the bias in this huge amount of data you're acquiring, how do you really validate? And given that you can't repeat the experiment, we can't do the election again, you can't really know what people thought or would have done, how do you validate your conclusions?
So let me start first, I guess, with the issue of bias. Yeah, so you're right that even if you randomly take a sample of people, the kinds of people that pick up the phone and answer surveys are indeed a biased sample. But it turns out that, if you have lots of information about the people that you're calling, you can correct for a lot of those biases. So, for example, if something happens in the course of a campaign that changes the dynamic of who is picking up the phone because one side gets more energized or gets more upset or something like that, you can actually see that because you know information about the people that you are attempting to call, and you can correct for it. Whereas if you're just adding up the responses of people that pick up the phone, you may get a biased answer. But if you correct for the fact that you know, hey, Democrats are really angry right now and they're like more likely to answer your survey, you can try to correct for some of those things. In terms of validation, one nice thing is that we can actually run lots of experiments and run lots of interventions to do validation. So we can build models, and we can then call people on the phone and compare our model predictions that don't use any of that data to what they tell us on the phone. Or, in your experience, if you send canvassers out to knock on doors for people who are likely to support us or be amenable to changing their mind, and 90% of them slam the door in those people's faces, you will hear about it, and that is kind of a validation in and of itself. The last issue, I think, was about whether this is a good thing for the political process or not. So I guess my comment about that is just that I think if we're ever in a spot where candidates are saying radically different or contradictory things to different slices of the universe, that's probably not a good thing. In our case, that's not really the issue. So if the data tells us that someone has expressed lots of interest to us about veterans issues, we would address them with policies about veterans issues. Or that they care about immigration, we would send a canvasser to tell them about immigration policies. It's not that we would send someone to say one thing about immigration to this person and another thing about immigration to another person. So obviously you can do that, but you could do that with, you can lie to different segments of the population with or without data, I guess, is what I would say to that. So.
I don't know if we should talk about the campaign. So I'm just playing. So my comment on this is it's always a hard balance. And going back to when we started predicting homicides and we felt we were doing a good job because the model seemed to be working, then you're faced with this ethical quandary of, do you go into a proper experimental model? So do you have a set-aside, right? And so this is where my weird lives start to conflict. You have this academic hat, which is like, oh, I need a set-aside. Then you have I am a sworn officer hat, and then you have this political hat, because can you imagine the pragmatic reality of if you have a set-aside, you predict a homicide in there, and then someone gets killed? That is a political nightmare.
What do you mean by set-aside?
So if I had two equal districts in which I'm predicting in both, but I don't take an intervention action. So in my set-aside, that could be highly problematic, and that's actually how you see any progress shut down in this environment. And if I were talking to my wife, who's a public health scientist, she'd pull out her classic, don't let the perfect be the enemy of the good. My stance is there are flaws in how we do this going forward. However, at least in my slice of the pie here, what we historically have done has been so exceptionally poor that we need to improve it. And I also think taking a more traditional academic approach, which often will take much longer, will have a more negative impact on an already problematic system.
I'll ask a couple of more questions and then we'll open it to the audience. Related to the issue of crime prediction and so on, one thing that comes to mind, and I'm sorry I'm bugging the people who are doing data in society as opposed to Ian, who does data in science. I can bug Ian as well, but society data in society is a softer target because you can't repeat experiments, really. I mean, that's the fundamental thing. And that point, that comes to my question, is that in society, this might even be true in this ad world, people start feeling what you're predicting about them. In fact, criminals are pretty clever. I'm not talking about, the murder that occurs because of some, random event or some, but let's say theft, mm-hmm. or organized crime. What if they knew that you have a method to predict how to do it? And maybe they've got a source in the department or something, they can very quickly change strategies. Nature doesn't change strategies at us. So if you observe, the ocean with 100 of these drones, you've got a reliable data set, right? But in society, you're saying, no, maybe even... Right. I'm not saying everything in nature, but there's a certain stationarity, and it doesn't... It's not an agent. And so I'm very curious when you do these predictive models, and this is also true, for example, models that predict financial behavior. Nobody ever really figures out what is the feedback into the herd when there's some prediction on how to invest and so on. So how do you guys think about that problem of the fluidity of the material you're trying to predict on?
So I'm always happy to talk about crime. So let me give you two really fast answers. The first one has to do with violence. Violence, you have this classic question of deter versus displace, right? And we found that with violence, and this is something we need to study beyond Chicago, but due to the interesting topology of gangs in Chicago, where originally you had your big gangs, now there are a lot of smaller gangs, we see more deterrence than displacement because the borders are so narrow. So we'd apply the treatment, and then we wouldn't then see something. If we had a target of 4 adjacent census blocks, we wouldn't then see it outside of target. And I think there's that whole gang piece in there, but at the same time, I worry about other crime types. So right now, this quarter, we're working on a project rebuilding something called the near repeat phenomena. The idea that if there's a property crime, there's an increased likelihood from event zero in a high resolution spatial and narrow temporal window of repeat crimes. Now, this is something that when implemented, I would expect will impact the system because people will know that in this target area, we know the probability we send in people and property crimes more portable. And that sends you into a mental spiral, right? Because you're like, oh, crap, I figured out how to predict it. And now everything's changing. So I think your point's really valid. I think there are different problem types which are going to have different manifestations.
I think the only thing I might add to that for our context is just that, it's a similar problem to, online fraud, where fraudsters are constantly gaming the system and you build a model to detect one thing and they're constantly trying to do something else and you have to rebuild your models to constantly be trying to detect the next thing. So in our context, we're calling many, many people on the phone every single day and rebuilding models. We repeat experiments that get done in the field to look for changes. I spent a lot of time doing online randomized email testing, and we would very frequently measure something with very good significance repeatedly, but know that this wasn't some law of nature we had discovered, and we would periodically continue to test it, and it would change, and people would get used to things. And so I think the only solution from my point of view is to be constantly rebuilding models, constantly getting new data to train those models on, constantly repeating experiments.
So I'd just like to push back gently on this idea that you can't, in social systems, you can't repeat experiments. I think with high-resolution data, you can do, you can use natural experiments, look to see where something is happening. A new store is put into one area but not into another area and see what results occur. Or you can, modulo the issues that Brett mentioned, apply a treatment in one area but not another.
Okay, we can open it to the audience. I think you step up to that.
Hello, my name is Marie Waltz. I work at a place called the Center for Research Libraries, and I work a lot on digital preservation. And a lot of what I'm hearing is about what we're doing with the data right now, but I'm not hearing a lot about what's going to happen to it in the future. And in particular, my questions to you were, one, do you think this data is going to be useful in 25 or 50 years? And two, what are you doing about digital preservation?
Yeah, well, the question of whether data will be useful, of course, varies greatly according to the data that we're talking about. Genomic data, perhaps, you don't need all of it because you can recollect it, modulo issues of evolutionary change. On the other hand, data about the activity in a city or the state of the planet is something that probably is going to be very precious. So I think what we don't yet have a good model, I think, of how much is data worth and therefore how much should we spend on preserving it, because we're only still in the midst of this transition from an era of data scarcity to one of data abundance. Where we can no longer afford to keep all of it. I'm involved myself in various data preservation projects, but only from the perspective of driving down the cost of preserving data by automating the preservation processes, not from the perspective of making the decision of what gets preserved and what does not.
So this question goes to Brad, I suppose. At the moment, profiling in the police is really a hot-button issue. So if we you know, profiles, you know, a black person driving or something thinking they were going to have marijuana, that's, everyone's hysterical. So data analytics, in a way, is exactly the same thing. It's profiling on a larger scale. And how long is it going to be before our society is freaked out about that? And are you worried about that in terms of, you know, basically, I guess that's putting a bias into the data by your profile?
So I wouldn't use the word freaked out, because I guess I'm talking publicly. I would say this is an issue I worry about, because it's fraught with interesting questions. So a problem I worked on a couple years ago, because I am interested in sort of person-based prediction as well as spatial prediction, is I called it the who would die problem. And could I predict who would be a victim of either a shooting or a homicide? Very, very interesting problem, right? And but then you develop this cohort who you then have the question of how do you intervene? And that sort of, that gets a bit toward the problem, but here's the challenge. That has a sister problem, right? Which I'm always hesitant to poke at, but we're going to need to poke at, which is, who's going to kill? And the challenge is, they're both solvable problems. And I made progress on the victim problem, and I think you can read plenty about these types of things, but what do you do when I produce a model which says my BFF Ian has a 0.78 chance of committing a homicide? So we joked about things like Minority Report, but let's forget all the Hollywood stuff. What do you do with that 0.78? So that's something that I don't think we know how to manage. And for those of us, and there's probably a few in the room, who work in data science, you don't get your absolute value. You know, you'd be pretty excited to have a value return at 0.78. But unfortunately, if you're not dealing in binaries, you just, how do you manage that? So there's a lot of these hard things, and unfortunately, as the models get better and better, we're going to have to find ways to answer that, and I just don't know that there are mechanisms to get there right now.
One more.
This on? Okay. Yeah. So my question has to do with some of the kinds of studies you're looking at involve potentially looking at data sets where people have this illusion of privacy and yet do not really have privacy. And so I have in general concerns about the use of things like, you know, social media, where people imagine incorrectly that they can write and not have their what they're writing be used against them. So one question is just, how do you deal with those issues? And I don't mean legally, I just in some sense mean socially. How do we deal with that? And the second issue is your model. Each of you have models for predicting things, but in particular, let's say the model for the probability that person X will commit a murder. Would you publish the model? Would you publish the data on which you base the model? And would you allow all that data to be publicly scrutinized? Because I think that's a hot potato.
Well, so, okay, I guess we're doing the hard questions. So to answer part of the question, well, there's two threads there. One of the things when I talk to sort of the second generation of chief data officers, I talk to them about thinking about their data sets more holistically and partnering with folks in CS to identify weaknesses and possible identification through both publicly available data sets and other alternatives. And I think this is an underdeveloped area which we need to find better ways to partner with government, because as I sort of preach to people and say you have 500 data sets out there, don't have the time bomb. And I think that's a good example of a public academic partnership which could make sure we don't blow up open data. On the second question, I am a big fan of putting out what I'm working on GitHub. So the algorithm, the approach, I want people to poke holes at what I'm doing and challenge it. I also believe somewhat strongly, as my sort of
post-open table life is how can I help government? I don't really want to commercialize these different things. So there's the approach there. However, the underlying data is different. In order to produce accurate predictions, you need to merge open and closed data. And I would be, certain closed data is just not releasable based on law. And it's also personally identifiable. So it would be hard for me to figure out a way to get there. And because legally it's not really allowed, I can sort of skirt the ethical piece.
I guess the only thing I would add about our data sources, there's a lot that gets said about the personal data that gets used in political modeling. And I think what I can say is that uniformly across the board, the things that are most useful to us are things that you willingly tell someone who knocks on your door with a clipboard and is very obviously writing something down, or someone who calls you up and says, you know, I'm conducting a survey of opinions and listens to what you tell them on the phone. So things that are like, you'd be hard-pressed to say you didn't know that that information was going to be used when someone knocks on your door with a clipboard. Things like consumer data, data on what people read, those things are just not that useful for us. In terms of publishing algorithms and techniques and data, the techniques that we use are not crazy proprietary rocket science modeling techniques. You know, anyone with a good undergraduate degree or a master's degree can come up with the same algorithmic stuff that we do. But really, it's the proprietary data that makes that stuff work. And I just can't imagine a world where at least the political parties are going to publish the data that they have about people. There's the other realm of it. You know, I talked a lot about media data, matching media consumption data to scores about people. And to me personally, that can be a little more troubling. So you all probably don't know it, but when you sign up for your cable service or your satellite service, somewhere buried in those terms of service, they're probably agreeing, or they're probably getting you to agree to share anonymized versions of what your television is tuned to. And to me personally, that was kind of surprising and is a little more problematic. And how we solve the problem of getting companies to read intelligible terms of service and getting people to read terms of service, I'm not smart enough to figure out how to solve that problem. But it is definitely an issue.
I'm sorry, the organizers said that we have to end now, so I guess that was the last question. Let me just one last comment to the audience. When you read an article that says that a machine learning algorithm has been used for X, stay skeptical. It sounds very scientific and very correct, but it might be very wrong. That's my last message to you.
I agree.